The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2011 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2011. If you have purchased this audio CD, you are free to make multiple copies of it for your own or your school's use. You may not sell copies of this audio or post it on the Internet. If you would like to find out more about the work of ACCS, please visit our website at www.accsedu.org. To order additional talks from this conference, please visit the ACCS website and click on Conferences. Thank you for your support of ACCS.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and begin, and we'll just let people join us as they will. If you're joining us, please make sure you have a handout off the front row. It says The Art of Latin, Latin Texts and Translations. It will prove very helpful as we look through our slides today as a good frame of reference for you. I believe that in the conference notebook it provides my email address. So if you would like a digital copy of the handout or of the PowerPoint later on, please feel free to email me. I just ask that you put Latin in the subject line because more than likely you'll go to my junk mail. Not that I think you're junky. But heavy junk mail folder for spam. But typically, spammers and scammers don't put Latin in their subject line. So if you'll put Latin in your subject line and email me, then I'll be happy to respond to you and send you these. So one more time, if you're coming in late, please get a handout off the front row. You'll find it very helpful as we go through. Well, this is The Art of Latin, and I am Karen Moore from Grace Academy of Georgetown, so I hope you're in the right place. If you teach Latin, if you teach art, if you teach literature or history, you are in the right place. This talk will be something that I think will be of great help and interest to you. But before we begin, I'd like to open with a word of prayer, if you'll join me. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are a creative God. You make this world a beautiful place in which to live. And through art, through language, we get to explore this creativity that you've given us. I pray that you would please bless this time together as we explore these things. I pray that you would please be with me and help me to articulate this lesson well, that it would be a blessing to those here who join us, that it may in turn be a blessing to those who may take the information back to. In the name of Jesus Christ, we pray. Amen. All right. As I said, I teach Latin. I'm the Latin chair at Grace Academy of Georgetown, deep in the heart of Texas. So if you see a little accent, that's where it's coming from. And I have taught Latin in grades 3 through 12, depending upon the year. I've also taught ancient humanities and a little bit of Greek when the opportunity presents itself. And one of the things that I like to do is incorporate many facets into my Latin class or into my humanities class. And that is what I'm here to share with you today. So I'm going to begin with a question that I present to some of my students as we look into literature, whether that literature is written in Latin or has been translated into English. And I will bring in before them a poster print of the famous Starry Night by Van Gogh, and I will bring in an imitation piece drawn by a much younger person, and I will ask the students the question, which one is created by the master? And of course, some of them are too nice. They don't want to say which one, especially if they know that the other art piece was drawn by my second grade daughter. They don't want to offend the teacher, right? This one is not hers. It's a different one. But I encourage them, no, we can call art a lot of things. And certainly we don't expect a second grader to be on the level of a master. Right? So if we're looking at two pieces of art, what are some of the things that would say this piece is the master, this piece is a novice? And this is a nice example of extremes. So looking at this, let me ask you, what tells you, what sets apart the masterwork from the amateur, from the novice? No one can tell? Okay, texture. Yes, the real one has a lot more texture. You can only go so far with finger paint. Okay, so more texture. Anything else? The houses. What about the houses? Okay, more defined. So the lines, the use of lines. Okay, yes? Oh, that's a good one. Okay, it has motion. And obviously this is not like motion picture. It's not video. It's still art. So what do you mean by motion? Okay, so good. It's his use of lines and shapes that give you the sensation of movement, the appearance of movement. So, yeah, those are all very good observations. Color, lines, texture. These are a lot of the things that we might consider in art analysis. Typically, the tools are composition, the arrangement of things on a page, color, the medium, finger paint versus oils, acrylics, watercolor, so forth and so on. And expression or mood. Do you get a sense of emotion from one painting over the other? Probably so. A lot of good art will make you feel a little bit of something. So what I want students to think about as they look at Van Gogh and look at art analysis is I want them to begin thinking of literature as art. It is an art form. And I ask them then, if we look at Van Gogh's painting and we analyze it according to its composition, its color, its medium, its expression or mood, and we get into those discussions, how might we apply that same thought to literature? So looking at tools. In art, we talked about things like composition, drawing, lines, color, expression. Well, for literature, we have similar tools that we use to create an image. And while the image isn't before our eyes in a pictorial form, it is an image that the author is trying to create and evoke in his writing. I remind them that in the days of Virgil and Ovid, they did not have DVDs and videos, not even black and white television yet. So the authors were really writing to evoke emotion and image. So what are some of the tools that they use? Well, certainly their composition, their arrangement, how they choose to tell the story, in what order, what details to include. Vocabulary. By vocabulary, I really mean word choice. Why do I choose storm the gates over swoosh, right? Or thunder. What word do I choose and why am I choosing that word? And then word arrangement, especially when you get into poetry. We see the effects of word arrangement. Do I leave out a small word? Do I rearrange the juxtaposition of words? And then rhetorical devices, also called literary devices. Things like alliteration, anaphora, litotes, things of this nature. All of these are tools in the hands of a writer, like the paintbrush and the paint are tools in the hands of the artist. And this is something I want them to begin seeing, to just approach literature in a different way. One of the things that I will do then as we read a story, whether it's in Latin or in English, is I will often bring in pieces of art. And one of the things I want them to see, first of all, is to begin applying this visual image to what they're reading. This generation is so very visual. Think about all the games they play, the movies they watch, interactive. And sometimes having that all flashed right before them, I'm not sure that cripple is the right word, but it's what comes to mind in when they're reading to engage their imagination with some of these books, especially if it's one that they perceive as old, dead, dry, you know, that awful stereotype we get with things of written by Latin and Greek guys who have long been dead and couldn't have anything to do with what we're reading. And I want to show them, no, these men were writing with a vision in mind. And men like Raphael and Michelangelo and these other artists that we're going to look at, they had that classical education. They didn't just read Dallaire's book of Greek heroes and myths. They had read the Odyssey, they had read the Aeneid, they had read the Metamorphoses in the original language. So when they were imagining a story, they were very likely recalling the very words of Virgil or Ovid. And so I want to bring these paintings in for a twofold reason. One is to help reinforce and give image and life to what they're reading, But the second thing I'm doing is I'm bringing in an art study, an art appreciation. When you look at this art piece, or when you go to a museum and view other art pieces, here are things to consider and look for and watch for and appreciate as you look at this art. So my first piece, or my first pair of pieces, are going to be two pieces, both titled Quos Ego. Those of you familiar with Virgil's Aeneid might recognize these lines from Book 1, and this is where your outline comes in very handy, because we're going to look at the lines. Now, for those of you who might not be of a Latin background, I've provided both the Latin and the English. The English is a translation by C.S. Lewis, okay, which I love. Apparently, he began a translation of the Aeneid, but sadly did not finish it, and I really wish he had, because after having read it this spring, I love his word choice. But I'm giving you his translation and not a literal translation, although his gets pretty close, because it's poetry, and he's trying to evoke image as well. So I want to give you something that you would see in your humanities class. So one thing we would do is we would read the Aeneid, whether it's in English or in Latin, and we would read this scene from Book 1. It is the scene where Juno has mischievously cajoled Iolaus into sending out the winds to stir up trouble for Aeneas and his fleet. And Neptune senses that something is amiss in his realm, and how dare they come in and mess on his turf without his permission. It is just unthinkable. He is irate, and he raises his calm head out of the sea and gives them what for. And this is a scene depicted in these lines from the Aeneid and in the lines up here. So as you read through this, I might show them this painting and say, well, actually, Raimondi on your left is an engraving, and then Rubens is a painting on the right. And let's discuss how these pictures portray Virgil's lines in the Aeneid. So again, I would open it up for discussion and say, what do you see in the painting that is reflected in the literature? Okay. In both cases, you can see the fleet in the background. In Rubens, here we have a ship. Raimondi's a little bit more difficult to see, but if you look, here's the end of a ship as it's sinking down. Here's another one in the back. So you have the ships disjointed. Okay. What do you notice about Neptune? Does he fit the description of Virgil? Does he look calm? Calm yet angry. Now, that's a skill, isn't it? To be angry yet calm at the same time. In Rubens, though, he's a bit more of the old man of the sea, whereas Raimondi, he looks more like the quintessential Greek god, all ripped and buff, right? But in both scenes, he's clearly taking command. We'll look a little bit more at the lines in just a minute, but I want to kind of take a shift over and discuss the artwork itself. So I'd say, okay, let's look at Raimondi and Rubens as not only interpreting what we see in the passage, but also their styles. Marcantonio Raimondi lived 1480 to 1534, and he was an Italian engraver known for the first important printmaker, whose body of work consists mainly of prints copying paintings. This is actually a work that Raphael sketched out and encouraged him to create as an engraving and a print. Peter Paul Rubens lives a little bit later, 1577 to 1640, and he is a Flemish Baroque painter, often influenced by Raphael, and he's known for an exuberant Baroque style. You can see that. I mean, there's a very big difference in the style, as we talked with Neptune already. And he is known for his Counter-Reformation altarpieces, portraits, landscapes, and history paintings of mythological and allegorical subjects. Another item that Rubens is noted for are his what have become known as Rubenesque women, meaning they're nice and plump. Okay? Kind of wish that was still in style. It'd make things a lot easier. But something else we can talk about. In the Renaissance, there was something known as the Golden Triangle, or the Renaissance Triangle, which we can see demonstrated in Rubens' painting, where you have Neptune as kind of the top of the triangle, but then to balance him, we have these nymphs here on the left, and we have the horse, the mad horse over here on the right. And it's hard to see in this image, but right over here behind him, we see Triton blowing a conch shell. And he does appear not in this passage, but if we fast forward a few more lines, he does appear in the Aeneid as helping Neptune sort everything out along with the nymphs. So we're putting those back in here. Raimondi, on the other hand, we already said he's an engraver, so there's that difference as well. But in this piece, he's actually imitating the style of Dürer, who was German and therefore part of the Northern Renaissance. And so this takes on a little bit more of an Eastern perspective. One thing you could talk about is the horizon. If you notice between the two paintings, with Rubens, we have a very clear horizon, and it almost helps to contrast a calm versus a storm. Whereas with Raimondi, the horizon's lost, and it almost helps enhance the turmoil of the passage and the chaos. But we still have our little winds up here and up here, and Neptune putting them in place. So that might be a class discussion that we would have on the styles of the art and then how the art interprets the painting. What might I do with that as an assignment? Well, there's a couple of things we might do. One thing that I like to do is a dialectic journal for my students to get them writing, to get them thinking about putting these things down in pen, especially because I do teach an advanced placement course in Latin, and one of the skills you have to hone there is literary analysis with support from your Latin passage. So if you look at the next page, you should see some samples of student work. And the first one is called Quos Ego Art Analysis. And what I ask the students to do is to pick one of these paintings and write a journal entry, so not a full-fledged essay, just a short journal entry, telling me what it is you see in the painting, how does the painting interpret Virgil? This is Raimondi and Raphael's interpretation of Virgil, or Rubens' interpretation of Virgil. How well does he do that? And so what you see here is the response. The famous scene from the Aeneid in which mighty Neptune rises from the sea and confronts the winds has been depicted many times by the artists. I'm going to flash forward to the second paragraph. The carving, he's obviously chose Raimondi's piece, brings to life Neptune's rising from the sea. Summa placidum caput extulit unda. He raises his calm head from the highest waves. So here I've asked them to point out the very Latin words they're using. In Raimondi's piece, we really do see the composure of the sea god, especially in contrast with the fierce winds, frantic Trojans, and Neptune's own crazed-looking horses. Yet we also glimpse Neptune's wrath somewhat as he grips his trident looking directly at the two winds. And he goes on to continue to cite the Latin for those places. Skip down to the third paragraph. I want to call your attention to the first two sentences there. The depiction of the surrounding waters is also quite accurate. There are scattered in the sea a number of people and objects. And he's quoting a line that's not in your handout, but it was about, I think, 10 lines earlier than this passage. Apparent rari nantes in gurgita wasto arma virum tabulaeque et troia gaza per undas. The scattered men appear swimming in the vast abyss, arms of men and planks in the Trojan treasure. And you can see some heads bobbling in the water. You can see a treasure chest floating. So you can see that he's really drawing attention to the wreckage. So this might be one way to draw attention to this one. Another lesson I might have is to show them the full engraving. The Quos Ego is the centerpiece for a larger panel that Marcantonio engraved. And this actually shows several scenes from the Aeneid. He shows several scenes beginning with Juno, see if I get my pointer to work, Juno talking to Aeolus about the winds. And if you can notice, between these panels, these engravings, you will see lines in which they're not taken directly from the Aeneid, but they're lines in which Marcantonio is explaining what is happening. And this would make a fun lesson for students to pass this out, ask them to read the lines out loud and discuss, okay, what do I see in this picture? What is this telling me? How does this help us review the story? Another more involved project for your artists is to ask them to create their own artwork based on Virgil's lines. Looking again at your samples of student work, this is Dido dying. It was drawn by one of my students, junior in high school this year. And I asked her to choose any scene, or asked the class to choose any scene from the Aeneid that they wanted, and to depict that scene in art. And I said, just like we've looked at art pieces and seen little details that the artist has included from different lines, I want you to do the same thing. And I want you to give me a short descriptive explaining what it is that you have drawn and why. Now, of course, she had to take the scene of Dido dying, and I hate when people die with their eyes open. She knows this, that I may have to deduct points. But it's still, creepy as it may be for me, it's still very, very good. She's very talented, and she did well. Okay. Yes. This is her description. And she has, my preference, honestly, would be to cite the specific lines. She cited the pages in general, and so those page numbers are for the translation that she was using. Okay, so they're not, so it doesn't get as specific. But again, I told her I didn't ask her to be as specific as this other analysis piece. It was a different assignment. So, okay. Well, moving on from poetry, let's talk a little bit about history. The war with Hannibal. This is often something included in our humanities classes, written by Livy in Latin. And you can find a lot of pieces of art, quite a few, that like to deal with the different periods of the Punic War. And the elephants are always particularly of interest. How many people use elephants to fight today? Not so many. So the idea of these, you know, tank-like elephants barreling down at the oncoming hordes is always intriguing. And so sometimes I'll have Elephant Day, as we read Livy, and I'll tell them, bring an elephant to school, and we'll pass out peanuts still in their shell. And so we'll eat peanuts with our elephants while we look at elephants. A little corny, but it's fun. We need to be corny every now and then. Keeps us real. So we're looking at two pieces here. Romano on the left, painted about 1521, and Mott, a little more contemporary, 1890. I don't want them to think that the influence of classical pieces on art stopped with the 1700s. It doesn't. It continues even today. We can find people who are inspired by historical events, people, places, literature, and want to interpret that. So here again, the next page in your packet gives you two excerpts from Livy's history. It's book 30, chapter 33. And I've just given the pieces that really pertain to this passage, and there's a translation at the bottom. So a couple of things I would call your attention to. Well, let's talk about the artist, actually. Giulio Romano was an Italian painter and architect, a pupil of Raphael. His stylic deviations are from high Renaissance classicism, but he was also helped to define a style known as mannerism. And this is what I would call students' attention to here, is the mannerism. It's a style in the fine arts developed principally in Europe during the 16th century, chiefly characterized by complex perspectival system, an elongation of forms. You know, in those funny houses where you stand in front of the mirror that makes you look tall and skinny? That's a lot of what he's doing here, and you can kind of see that in the painting on the left. It's also characterized by strained gestures or poses. So you're in intense action, freeze frame. You can see that developed really here as well. And often intense color, which you can also see. His use of color is very vivid in this piece. We have elongation of forms. The students like to see all the horses' derrieres. That always interests them. They notice that right away. But so we have this elongation of forms, this strident color, this mass. Whereas Mott is a big contrast. The elephants, to me, look a little bit more powerful. And it's the black and white contrast. Mott lived 1846 to 1922, and he specialized in historical and mythological paintings. Some other ones that you might look at are Hannibal's Crossing of the Rhone with the elephants. Is another excellent one. And if you read the Gallic Wars, he has a painting of Vercingetorix surrendering to Caesar. So there's things you can do with that too. So again, we might look at the Latin passage or the English reading and ask students to note, how does the painting interpret the work? Well, one of the lines I might first call their attention to is the very first line, that in order to cause terror, Hannibal drew up the elephants first in battle array, meaning they were the first line, which is good. If I was a soldier, I would not want to be standing right in front of the elephants. That seems a little dangerous. There were, however, 80. Not in any battle line at any time before had he so many. And I love the way that Livy emphasizes this if you look at the Latin. Quot nulla unquam in acie ante habuerunt. Not in any battle line, ever. Had there been so many, had he ever had so many. So when you look at these two paintings, which one would you say better interprets that image? Probably the one on the right, because you get the massive number. You get them all lined up. In fact, I don't know if you can tell, but you even see one. Oh, my blinker's not working. Right here, he's lying down. He went down, and there's one rearing up behind him. So you've got this very thick image of these elephants all in battle line. Be pretty intimidating. Another one I would call your attention to, well, of course, then it talks about after the line of elephants, you have the auxiliaries, the Lurgians and the Gauls and all the battle lines behind them. And you don't really see that as much in Mott's painting. The elephants tend to overpower it. But I think that's the very sense he wanted, was the power of the elephants. Whereas in Romano's, you can kind of see back behind the elephants masses and masses of people. So you kind of get the idea more of this mixed group, right? We have this group of people and this group of people and this group of people, and they're all mixed together right behind these elephants, this massive, massive force. All right. Then if we move down a little bit, let's see. In the second paragraph, about halfway through, you see where he talks about nevertheless an intrepid... Well, in the second paragraph, the general, the Romans blow their trumpets, and apparently it unnerves the elephants a little bit. And nevertheless, I'm looking about in the middle of that second paragraph, an intrepid few of the beasts driven against the enemy were putting forth great destruction among the orders of light-armed soldiers, along with their own many wounds. The light-armed troops began leaping back to the maniples and making way for the elephants. What the Romans did, having encountered elephants before, they knew me versus elephants, not going to happen. So they learned also that the elephants, they really don't turn right and left on a dime, you know. It's not your little sports car. It's more like the great big honking bus. Right? So they learned that if I just jump to the side, he'll go right past. And so that's what the Romans did. They lined up, elephant come, we step out of the way, elephant goes by, and we throw spears at him as he goes by and hopefully wound the elephant, kill the people on the elephant, something like that. So this is what Livy is describing. Now, again, which of these paintings might better interpret the chaos of the elephants as they panic at the sound of the trumpets? The Romano might. So we could just say these are different stages of the battle. And again, it's just a nice discussion to have. They're learning about the art. They're learning about critiquing art. But they're also learning to really think about the passage in a way that they probably didn't do when they were reading it for homework last night. And it's just getting that visual before them. All right, I'm going to go back to poetry for a moment now to discuss another, to look at our last bit of artwork. You just have to know this about me. I love Latin poetry. Prose is great. History is fascinating. I love poetry. So we're going to look at a piece called The Landscape with the Fall of Icarus and how well it aligns with Ovid's Metamorphoses. Now, I first came upon this painting as I was teaching an ancient humanities class using the Omnibus 4 book. And we were in the unit on the Metamorphoses, and this painting happened to be here. And it really struck me. I loved it. It's by a gentleman named Bruegel, 1525 to 1569, born in the Netherlands, was a Flemish Renaissance painter and printmaker known for his landscapes and peasant scenes. He actually was so intrigued in representing the peasantry in their daily life, that he was known frequently to dress up as a peasant and mingle in funerals and weddings and party crasher instances, dress as a peasant, so that he could really get a feel for what the peasant life was like, so that he could better represent that in his work. So he came to be known as Peasant Bruegel. That was his nickname. And you can see that his painting very much looks like a scene of everyday life. But what I would ask students to do, well, of course, the title kind of gives it away, the fall of Icarus, but if you hide the title, you could ask them to figure out which myth this represents, or say, can you find Icarus in the painting? Now, I won't ask you to find Icarus in the painting because it's really hard when you're looking at it up close. So it is a slide far away, it might be hard. But Icarus has his grand debut right here. He's just a pair of legs splashing around in the ocean, which is kind of odd. He's the title character, but he's off in the corner, almost as obscure a spot as he can be. Very, very interesting. So again, if you flip your outline, you'll see Ovid's Metamorphoses, the Latin on the left, and an English translation by Charles Martin on the right. So again, I would say, this is a very interesting interpretation by Bruegel. Let's look again at Ovid and see why it was that he would choose to represent the poem in this manner. What do you see again? I'm putting it back on you. I know the answers. What do you see in the poem that's reflected in the painting? Oh, good. Yes, the sun is up there. You almost can't even see where exactly the sun is because it just lights up everything. What else?
The idle shepherd.
Yes, he's down there with his dogs and his sheep. Okay, describing the surrounding events. Yes. Right. Right, it's like it's a normal day in the life, and whoop, guy falls out of the sky. A little bit odd. One thing it reminds me of, and we talk about this a lot in class too, if I was directing a movie of this scene, how would I set it up as a director? How would I get this idea across as a director? And this reminds me very much of a scene in the movie Thor. I took my sons to see it the other week. And, okay, I know, yes, we've gone from Latin to paintings to Thor. It's all there. Thor's kind of classical, though. Norse mythology, it works. So there's a scene, and I don't know how many of you have seen the movie, where the great big destruction robot dude that blows out fire at everybody to destroy them, and he's sent to Earth by the bad guys to get Thor and the good guys. It's kind of the synopsis. But you don't see him coming out of the sky. What you see is a landscape of the town with everybody doing their normal everyday things. And suddenly in the background, huge meteor-like action, kaboom! And that's kind of in my mind what this has happened here. He's trying to show it was just another average, ordinary day. It's not like somebody expected this guy to fall out of the sky. There were no warning signs. Nobody knew what was going to happen next. It just happened. And everybody's going on with their everyday life. So it's the same kind of idea, and this is what Bruegel is trying to emphasize. And we see this in the first line, aliquis captat pisces, anyone snatches up fish. So we'll see if there's a fisherman down here in the right-hand corner. There's a fisherman, okay? Then we have the pastor, the shepherd, and the arator, the plowman, plowing his fields. And they're all going about their everyday life. And then we have Icarus fall out. Look at the end of the story, or the end of the passage, I should say, which to me is just so moving. We're looking at the lines that start, Oraque caerulea patrium clamantia nomen. And we have Icarus as he falls, and it says his mouth, his shouting mouth, calling the name of the Father, are snatched by the blue waves. Oh, that's such a powerful image. He's falling. He's calling, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And the words are snatched by the water. You might ask a student, describe that to me. What would that look like? What kind of mood music would be in the background if this was a movie? You know? And then you have the unhappy father, the pater infelix, calling out for his name. And what does he notice? Penas aspexit in undis. He sees the feathers. He saw the feathers in the waves. And you can kind of see, if you look at the painting closely, it's hard to see from here, but there are actually feathers kind of falling out, flittering in the air around him, and then on the waves. just the feathers. That's all that's left. Oh, very sad. So again, ask them, what elements from the poem do we see? What elements are added? Do you see something added in this painting that Avi didn't mention? The ship. Avi doesn't talk about a ship anywhere. But here Bruegel has added a ship sailing on. Ship just passes him by. Ship's doing its own thing. Almost tragic. Like there's help right there, but they're so caught up in their everyday life. They're just going on. Or maybe they didn't even see him. Who knows? Would you say that the addition of the ship is in keeping with what Ovid was writing? Or is it taking a left turn? Be another discussion to have. Okay? Now, one other thing that I found very interesting, if you turn to the last sheet in your outline, is that this painting by Bruegel actually inspired, so Ovid writes his poetry and inspires Bruegel to paint. Bruegel paints, and he inspires other authors to write poetry. And so here we have two poems, one by Auden and another by William Carlos Williams, called, both of them are about this painting. The first one, I hope I pronounced this right, Musée des Beaux-Arts, is named for the art museum in Brussels, Belgium, which happens to be where this painting is housed, and is also a town that Brussels was the hometown for Bruegel later in his life. He lived there. So very appropriate that it's housed there and that the title is actually calling the reader's attention to this museum. So you know the poem's going to be about the artwork. But looking at it in the first couple lines, about suffering, they were never wrong. The old masters, how well they understood its human position. The old masters, it's capitalized here, so he's referring to some specific group of people. Who might it be? If I'm looking at Bruegel, what might I consider the old masters? Could be Bruegel, yes. Could be Ovid. I don't know if that Auden's thinking that, but that's kind of what I think of too, because he is the one that inspired Bruegel. Okay? I'm going to go about halfway down the poem, a little more than halfway down the poem. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, Auden basically is waxing eloquent about tragedy, and then he comes specifically to Bruegel's work. In Bruegel's Icarus, for instance, how everything turns away quite leisurely from the disaster. The plowman may have heard the splash, the forsaken cry, but for him it was not an important failure. The sun shone, as it had to, on the white legs disappearing into the green water, and the expensive, delicate ship that must have seen something amazing, a boy falling out of the sky, had somewhere to get to and sailed calmly on. So again, he takes this scene and he evokes the same emotion, the same pathos that he feels Bruegel is trying to get to. And he is, as Bruegel was commenting on specific elements of Ovid's poem, this poet is commenting on specific elements, the shepherd, the ship, the sun, within Bruegel's painting. Another shorter poem, Landscape with the Fall of Icarus, by Williams. According to Bruegel, when Icarus fell, it was spring. Well, it definitely looks like it could be spring. A farmer was plowing his field. The whole pageantry of the year was awake, tingling near the edge of the sea, concerned with itself, sweating in the sun that melted the wing's wax. Unsignificantly, off the coast, there was a splash, quite unnoticed. This was Icarus drowning. So again, very, very tragic, and yet a little humorous. But we, in both poems, you have the idea of the insignificance of it all. In Bruegel's painting, the insignificance of it all. So what might I ask students to do after a wonderful, cheerful discussion like that? Well, as I said, this was in the context of studying Ovid's Metamorphoses, which is quite extensive. Icarus's story is, perhaps ironically, one insignificant, mere story in all of them. So what I asked the students to do, having looked at several art pieces over the course of the year, was to go find their own art piece. And their assignment was to find an art piece that represented some mythological story within Ovid's Metamorphoses. And they had to bring in their journal that they kept, a printout of that piece. I wanted to know the author. I wanted to know the date. I wanted to know the style, the medium of painting, of the, excuse me, of the artwork, whether it was watercolor, oil, acrylic, what have you, engraving. And then I wanted them to write a poem based on that piece of art. I said, as Ovid inspired Bruegel, and then Bruegel inspired Williams or Auden, I want you to be inspired by this painting, and I want you to look at this painting and write a poem. It could be a haiku if you're really feeling stretched and stressed. But I want you to write your own poem in any style that you choose that interprets this painting for me. And that was a very fun assignment, to see the creativity. And this kind of took it from one painting in the classroom. If you think about it, most of them actually did not just choose the first painting that they saw. They were looking at a number of paintings to see which one might inspire them to write something. Which one did they think they could articulate well? And it was just a lesson in getting them to look at art in another way. And that's really what I want them to do with these lessons, is to begin to look at literature as art, to begin to envision literature as they read it and appreciate all the tools that the author has to bring to create this image within the reader's mind. But then also to begin to look at art in a new way, to look at art as something that was inspired by this classic literature, this classic body of work that we've been studying for all these years, and make application to it. So that the next time they go to a museum, the next time they look through an art book, that art has new meaning because they know what inspired it. So thank you very much. I hope that I've given something to inspire you just a little bit. And at this time, if anybody has any questions, I'm more than happy to entertain those. Or certainly please feel free to go off to lunch if you need to do so. Any questions? Yes, ma'am. Sure. Right. The question is about statues. I focused on paintings in this presentation because it's very difficult for me to stay within the time frame usually, because I just get going. And so I was trying to keep it simple. But yes, I actually bring in sculpture as well, particularly when I'm doing the Aeneid. And we're spending an entire year in our Latin class reading Virgil's Aeneid, and I'll bring in paintings, not only paintings, but also sculptures. Because sometimes it's a bust, but sometimes it's a whole scene. Like there's one of Aeneas carrying Anchises on his shoulders, holding the Penates and little Ascanius by him. And so even in that, we can see what details they include. And there was one that I saw of, let's see, who was it? It was Cupid and Psyche. Incredible piece of marble. First of all, it just amazes me that somebody takes rough stone and makes it just soft and lifelike. And you think it could just start breathing any second. But there was a vial, one of the tasks Persephone had, that Psyche had was to go steal Persephone's beauty. Venus told her, I want, and apparently she had this little box. And the temptation, of course, was much like we see, was the idea that I want to open it. I want to see if I have some for myself, right? So she opens it, and it overwhelms her, and she passes out. So, and then Cupid comes and revives her. So in this sculpture, you see Cupid reviving his love, Psyche, and back behind her, in a very insignificant place, you see the open vial, which is just very interesting. It's just this little detail. Or there's another one I love. It's called the Dying Gaul. But all the details in him that make him, his hair, his face, the collar he's wearing around his neck, his armor, they're very small details, but it's a way to say, okay, this is what a Gaul looked like, and this is what a Roman looked like. And here's some telltale characteristics from what we've read of what the two would look like. So, yes, sculpture is fantastic, and you can do a lot with that. And I'll tell you honestly, when I want to do this, I get on Google, and I will start to say, I want to find something about the Battle of Zama, for example. I wanted to find some artwork of Hannibal's elephants. And that's a great resource to help you filter through and find pieces of art that you might want to use. Yes, ma'am. Yes. So classical school recommendations for new classical school on curriculum. Are you talking about with respect to Latin, with respect to literature? To art and literature. I don't. It's something I've written a few Latin books I'd like to do one day is a compilation of the two. But this is something that I just do in my own classroom. And it's really not terribly difficult. I'll tell you my two secrets. One of them I've already shared. You know, I'll go search for a painting. I'll know what literature I'm reading, and I'll think, okay, what are the big events, major memorable events in this work? And I'll start searching. And then I am not an artist by trade, but my mother, my sister, and my cousin are all artists. And we have a very talented art teacher at our school. You know, one great thing about classical education, we're a community. Nobody's supposed to do this all on their own. So I'll talk to the art teacher and say, this is what I'm studying. This is what I want to look at. Here are the paintings between Raimondi's engraving and Rubens' oil painting. What do you notice that I as a novice might not? And so I'm learning as I go in order to teach the students. Or I'll go to the art teacher and say, I'm thinking about looking at some of these paintings. What would line up well with what you're doing? And one assignment that's fun, the engraving that Marco Antonio did, okay, it's when they take a piece of metal or something and they etch it and then pour ink and make a print. Well, she did a very similar project with our 7th grade open studio art class using linoleum. Who knew you could use linoleum to create art? But she would take the backs of linoleum, have them engrave on it, and then make a print. So that might be a way, too, to integrate that in your art class and say, we're going to be looking at an engraving with respect to the Aeneid. You know, what do you have to help me? So, unfortunately, I don't have anything set that I can just hand you, but just encourage you to explore that way. Yes, sir? Yes. Yes. And that's another thing. I like to incorporate computer technology in my class because it would be very expensive, cumbersome, time-consuming to go find all these prints and bring them in. So if you have a laptop and a power projector, it's free. And I can just copy and paste them. There are a lot of sites, too, I would encourage you to look, where it allows you to zoom in on the art and look all over it. Vatican has a lot of great pieces, and you can go into the room like you're walking into it three-dimensionally and tour it that way, and you can zoom in on places. So I would encourage you to really have fun exploring with those options. Yes, ma'am. Yes, she's asking about my blog site. I have a blog site. It's latinaliveonline.com, all one word, latinaliveonline.com. And I actually already have two pieces of artwork up there, one of the Quos Ego pieces and then something called the Loham Mosaic, which is a mosaic that was excavated in London. A gentleman was digging a hole to bury his dead sheep. And lo and behold, there's a Roman mosaic. And it tells really the story of Dido and Aeneas. And so that's a really neat piece. And I intend to put more up, more on there as well. Anybody else? All right. I am going to be stationed at the Classical Academic Press booth during most of the conference, as that's where my wares are being sold. So if you do think of further questions or would like to talk more, please do come by and see me and enjoy the rest of your conference. God bless you.